You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Oh, oh, oh.
Hello, Scott. So how are you on this Christmas edition?
I'm pre-Christmas.
That was rubbish.
I think that's the only way I can describe it, pre-Christmas.
You are pre-Christmas. So how's your build-up?
I hate it.
You hate it?
Rubbish. I hate it. I hate it. I even left the house today just to get away from things, people.
Why? What's wrong with Christmas?
Oh, what's right with Christmas? Oh, I don't hate it.
Actually. Oh, you're a curmudgeonly old so-and-so, so I'm going to ask you a different question.
No, I'm not. It's just Christmas, isn't it? Christmas is Christmas.
Honestly, I've been weeping little Santas with happiness.
Oh, God.
That's literally what I've been doing. No, it's a different sort of weeping. I'm getting confused. Well, this week is very exciting because we've got a guest. It's a little three-way conversation, mm-hmm. and I'd like to introduce our guest, Suddenly Mummy. So, hello, Suddenly Mummy.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very Christmassy. Not weeping Santa tears, I must say.
Are you not?
Yet.
Yet. He's a cynic. But you are not Suddenly Mummy, are you? I mean, you are Suddenly Mummy. Everyone knows you as Suddenly Mummy. But what's your real name?
Rachel. Let's call me Rachel.
Let's call me Rachel. We'll run with that. We'll run with that. Hello, Rachel.
Hi.
I was slightly...
Hi, Rachel.
See, Scott's cheered up champion. Now, we've got a whole host of things, a smorgasbord of Christmassy things to get through this week. We've got an interview with Hannah Meadows, and she's going to talk us through some self-care, which is interesting. It's very interesting, actually. I was converted. But I'd like to talk to you about fostering, because I'm aware that we're a fostering and adoption podcast, but up till now, we've just been adoption. So, Rachel, tell me a little bit about yourself. Give me a little introduction to you and what you do and who you are and those kind of things.
Okay, well, I'm a single, short-term foster carer of preschool children, which I do for my local authority. I've been doing that for 6 years. I take emergency placements as well. In fact, almost all my placements have been emergency placements with half, maybe 90 minutes notice, 3 hours notice.
Wow.
That's how it goes. The children come with the clothes on the back from wherever, police stations, hospitals, other places, and stay with me for the shortest placement I've had was just a weekend. And the longest placement I've had, if you don't count the two children that I adopted, the longest placement I've had, fostering placement, was 18 months.
Wow.
And that was a challenge for adoption.
So why did you become a foster carer? That's my starting point. Feel free, Scott, as well, to ask questions.
I will once I finish my drink.
All right, okay. So why did you decide to become a foster carer?
Someone suggested it to me about 10 years ago, no longer, maybe 15 years ago. And I thought it was a stupid idea, and why would that person, what a ridiculous thing to say to me. I was a teacher at the time, and I really enjoyed that job. And as a single person, I couldn't see fostering and holding down a full-time job, mm-hmm. which, you know, it was just too much. And then I left teaching, and I went to live and work in Romania for 2 years.
As you do.
Like you do. And,
What were you doing in Romania? Sorry.
Well, what I did in Romania, I've been involved with a Romanian charity for about 16, 17 years. It's a charity set up by Romanians to make contact with children living in institutions in what we call orphanages. They don't call them that. While they're living in the institution, and then to catch them when they leave and assist them in transitioning to independent living.
So that's relevant experience, isn't it?
Yeah. So they did that. And the other thing that they did was they supported what was called the baby clinic in the city. Now, the baby clinic was a clinic. Some of the children there were sick, but actually all the children on the ground floor weren't sick. They were abandoned children.
Right.
So one of the things they did do was send in teams of people to go in, get the children out of their cots, play with them, and put them back, even if it was a couple of times a week, because they weren't getting that. And the children would stay in the baby clinics until they were old enough to go to the orphanages. And I think just watching that lack of that really sterile environment for the first few years of these children's lives, and seeing how that played out with the other end, with the teenagers and young women, because it was all women that we were working with, that were sort of orphanage graduates. For me, the connection between this neglect in the early years and then the how that compounded itself into the teenage years and beyond was so blindingly obvious that when I came back from that 2 years, I'd been every summer before that doing camps and different things. Yeah. And I did this 2 year thing. And when I came back from there, I just really thought, yeah, I think fostering is something I ought to be doing. And of course, I did the training, and everyone was saying to me, why are you not doing teenagers then? You've been a secondary school teacher, you've done loads of youth work. All of my experience before have been with teenagers. But it was these babies in the baby clinic that made that decision for me, because I had seen the outcome and I wanted to make the difference at the beginning. You know, it's a bit idealistic, I may be a bit naive, but I wanted to be there in the first 3 years to try and stop to try and do something about what the outcome would be if no one did something, if you know what I mean. It is idealistic, but you know, these are the things, this is what we do. So that was why. Well, that was why I did foster, and that's why I do little kids.
That's interesting, because often the accusation you get against foster carers is, oh, they're just in it for the money. And that's not my experience. I don't think I've maybe met one or two that needed the money, but that's not the primary reason they do it. You know, is that your experience? I mean, of the foster carers you know, because I presume that you know, you're in a circle of foster carers and you talk and you get to know them.
I think in general, if you went into foster care for the money, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
You need to work on your math. Because there isn't. No, go back to school, do your GCSE maths, and add that up again. Because for me, coming into fostering, and I was working in a private school, a very small private school, on comparative to a teacher's salary, a very low salary, really. It was a lot less than a teacher in a state school would be getting. And then I spent 2 years volunteering in Romania, and I still took a pay cut to do fostering. It still effectively was a pay cut for me. My first fostering placement, I received £150 a week.
That's not a lot to maintain a household. No, and
very small amount.
Well, because that's not a wage, that's an allowance. And so there's a...
That's an allowance, yeah.
You've got to cut out of that, haven't you? You've got to give children so much, and you've got to put away so much, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think the thing to remember about fostering, because I foster very young children... and although my local authority tells me it has no official policy on us working outside of the home, I was told in no uncertain terms there would be no placements for me if I was working outside of the home, because little children will only go to daycare or nursery if it's in their care plan. So if I wanted to foster the very youngest children, I really need to be available 24 hours a day. So really when you think about the allowances that are being given to foster carers, it's not just... It's to pay for what the child needs. And at that stage in their life, what the child needs is a 24-hour-a-day carer. So if you consider how much it costs to hire somebody to care for your child 24 hours a day, a child minder, really fostering, you know, it's not very much to allowance. If you look at it in that way, yes, they need food, formula, clothes, but they also need a place to live, a car to be taken to contact with, and a 24-hour-a-day care, these babies do.
Yeah.
And that the allowance needs to cover that, because that's what I'll be doing 24 hours a day. I don't know anybody whose motivation for fostering with money.
I think you're right, actually. And I do think there's very few that do it for money. But I think there are a few, and I say a few... just not to upset the mass, that actually do make money out of it. And that's quite annoying if you think about the people like yourself who, you know,
you're breaking up, Scott.
You know, 2 years in Romania. There's not many people who do that.
No, I mean, I think it's...
I'm always breaking up.
You are breaking up. Can you hear me? Emotionally and technologically.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yeah.
I'm still there.
Excellent. No, I think Scott's point's really valid, that there are, you know, if you've got three children in placement, then it is a significant amount of money, potentially.
Yeah.
Economies of scale, but that's not a, That's not normal or usual. And I see referrals coming in, and there's desperate for sibling groups, people who will take sibling groups, because people just don't have room for three children. You know, three bedrooms. Not many people have three spare bedrooms. I'd be interested to know your thoughts on the unionisation of foster carers, because I know that's something that's been dotting around, and I know there's lots of views, and I heard people literally having apoplectic fits on the radio about it. So where do you stand in all of that?
Yeah, I'm nervous about it because I'm not a very activist kind of person. I've never been in the union, actually.
Right.
So I think when people like me, who've never joined a union before, despite working in the public sector, and who, you know, we're fostering out of, I'm not expressing this very well, but I don't want to blow our own trumpets as foster carers, but most of us are fostering because of the children, because we see a need mm-hmm. with the children and we want to do something. So when people like that start getting all, let's make a union, somebody should listen, because a lot of these people are not political activists and they're not those kind of people. These are meek people, a lot of these people that are saying this. I'm nervous about it. I'm nervous about it because I don't want to be all radicalised. I'm nervous about it because actually we don't really have any rights as foster carers. So I don't know what right the union would be able to protect or defend if we don't have any, really. We can be dismissed. They can just not send us a placement. They can change our, my terms and conditions have recently been changed. We've had no say in it, really. Which has meant a cut in allowances for me and other cuts. So we're not really self-employed. We don't have full self-employment rights. We're not employed, so we don't have employee rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would like to see things. There are things I would like to see. If a union could help with that, I would consider it. But it's important we keep the children at the heart of what we do. That's the thing. If the children need to be at the heart of what we do.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I see that the number of referrals that come through to the agency I work for it was increased sort of tenfold over the last year. And I don't think that's peculiar to us. I see that often you'll see headlines that say, oh, foster care in crisis, you know, 9,000 carers wanted. And I kind of think that's not sustainable. They need carers, they need quality carers, they need people who... flexible, different types of carers, but it's not being sold as a job, is it? I mean, I think I'd be reluctant to become a foster carer again.
I think if you think about a historical idea of foster care, there would be one partner out at work and one partner at home anyway, children got a bit older, the second income isn't really needed, and, you know, it is just a bit of extra money to spend on to cover the expense of the child. I think that's a historical idea of what foster care was. And I think that's probably what a lot of people have in mind when they think about foster care. But I think increasingly people do need two incomes coming into the household. So I think that makes it difficult for people choosing to become foster carers. If you have to give up your job in order to care, you're going to need to replace the income that's gone missing with something. And I think as well, there's quite a lot of different kind of foster care. So I think life as a long-term foster carer is really different from my life as a short-term and emergency foster carer. I have a big problem with, in between placements, we get nothing. Now, if you've got a long-term placement that's going to last 6 or 7 years, that's probably not really a very big concern for you. Mm-hmm. But when I have placements, the longest is going to be 2 years. I find nearly every year I will have a period of time where I'm getting nothing.
And there's no guarantee about how long that could be. And if you've fallen to the bottom of your list, or for whatever reason you don't get to the top of the list, then, or even if you miss a call, you know, like you say, if someone calls you with a placement and they'll move very quickly on, especially for babies.
A lot of talking thoughts about unionisation was about holiday pay. And going on holiday and sick pay and that kind of thing. And it's not about that for me. I wouldn't want to take a holiday without the children I was fostering. I would prefer not to do that. If I fall sick, if I fall seriously sick and can't care, there is nothing. There is no safety net for me whatsoever. There's no sick pay for me. When I adopted my children, because I'm self-employed, there was no adoption pay for me. There's nothing for us. So we're not even truly self-employed. If my local authority doesn't have a placement for me, I can't phone the next local authority along and say, you know. So for all I know, my next door neighbour local authority, a mile and a half down the road, is crying out for foster carers to take in for placements, but I can't take placements from them. They'll be sending them out to agencies, and I'm sitting here with no placement. One of the things I'd like to see is foster carers have control of their own approval, that we hold our own portfolio and we're able to go from agency to agency.
I mean, that's a radical idea, and doing that across local authorities and independent foster care agencies. I mean, I think that something's got to change, and I think that there are sort of incremental changes. But I do feel that there's a, it's kind of based on a model that, you know, that there would be nice housewives sat at home who were bored, and, you know, the husband would be out working and they'd be foster carers. I think that those days are gone. They're well gone. And we need to adjust to a suit contemporary society. Are you still there, Scott?
I think I'm looking at Scott's table.
Scott's gone off and he's making himself a sandwich or something. Bless his heart. So, it's Christmas, and actually, Scott's back. I was going to ask Scott a question. Why did you become a foster carer?
Wow.
Not you, yous. You're interested.
Well, no, I mean, that is interesting, actually, because it was for me that we were going to become foster carers. And I'm not saying that my lovely husband didn't want to become one, but I'd, you know, given up work all those years ago to when the first two were placed. Seems like so long ago. I needed to do something, but I didn't know what to do. And I just couldn't bring myself to kind of end what had been that period for my kids that they'd enjoyed. So, you know, me being at home, essentially. And I remember when that happened to me as a child, and it was quite distressing in some ways, although at least you got to be a latchkey kid where you got to let yourself in and raid the cupboards. But that aside, I wanted to stay at home to be there for the kids. Gone the complete opposite way now, but when we were fostering, it just made sure that I was doing something. And
it kept you, in the house. And
well, exactly. Plus, you know, I, like we were saying earlier, you know, I knew it wasn't, it's not a pay, it's an allowance. So it wasn't going to, you know, it wasn't going to pay the mortgage off. I think that it was interesting because when we started looking into fostering, we looked at local authority and private agency. We decided to go private agency. And I'm not sure there's any benefit to doing, you know, to go in private agency. I think actually that, like yourself, Rachel, it's difficult when you go private agency, I feel, because you do get those kind of harder to parent children.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, they do become, well, they do come to you hard work. And they were looking at teenagers a lot as well. And I was thinking, when we first got our first placement, I was thinking, I don't want a teenager because I've got enough with that with my own teenagers. And it was really, you know, it was really difficult. So, but yeah, that's essentially why.
I mean, I guess...
Long story short.
No, I mean, swings and roundabouts, isn't it, with IFAs and local authority, independent foster care agencies and local authorities, is that local authorities, you probably get more availability, more children available, but IFA, you get perhaps more support but harder children to place. Right. So, quickly, we've got an action-packed podcast. We've got Hannah Meadows, who's talking about self-care. Now, where do you stand on self-care, Rachel? Do you believe in it? Is it a thing?
Let me be honest. Before the children, when people spoke about me time, which is what people call self-care outside of our community, I think. I've never heard anyone say self-care until I was a doctor. When I heard people speak about me time and needing me time and all of this, I must admit, I thought it was a bit, you know, a bit wimpy, really. I mean, be a southerner compared to you two, but I'm still a Norman.
I was going to say that's quite unusual for such a southerner.
That stands. You're not on the Ard there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so you get to be, right, okay, it's pouring with rain. We're still going to the park. We're still doing this. So beforehand, I had a busy life, but I did a lot of things. I pushed through. There was a lot of pushing through, bulldozing on, keeping going.
Hardcore.
This was hardcore, let's do it. I've come a full circle on it, I will say. And I'm constantly telling people you can't pour from an empty cup. This is my thing now. You cannot pour from an empty cup. I've tried it. It can't be done. So you have to fill your cup. Now, I'm really lucky when it comes to self-care because before I was a parent, I didn't care about getting my nails done or candlelit baths or going to the hairdresser. Many of the things that people talk about as self-care, I never liked that stuff before. So I don't miss it now. None of that bothers me. I never took any exercise. I didn't eat healthily. I didn't do any of that stuff before.
You are just fantastic.
I'm just not bothered. I'm just so I don't miss any of that. I didn't go out more. I did go out, but like at youth club, volunteering. You know, I didn't have like an exciting. I know I was terrible. So my idea before I adopted self-care was ordering a takeaway. You see, is ideal now because, of course, wonderfully, and this is one of the big advantages. I'm single. Nobody speaks to me. The remote control is mine. I can do whatever. There's no issue. What I've discovered for myself is, although I think I need to improve on the excess, I bought a bike because, you know, I'm laughing hilariously at that, but I bought a bike because we do need to get out and exercise more. And now the kids are getting a bit older, I can put the baby in a trailer and we can go. So I'm trying with that. What I've discovered about myself in the last 6 years is, at the end of the day, I need to have several hours, actually, where nobody speaks to me. That needs to happen a few times in the week.
Daily there. I was slightly worried.
Get off. Go away now. I'm finished with you. No, not that. But it does need to happen quite regularly. If I don't get that, that's what I need. That's what self-care turns out to be for me. Mm-hmm. It's head to head. And I would love to say that I spend that time reading a worthy book or watching some interesting. But I don't. I spend that time watching reruns of QI on Dave. I'm messing around on Twitter, as you'll probably have noticed.
I've seen you on Twitter, actually.
I'm playing Candy Crush Saga, which I'm on about level 1,000 and something. But I have to spend that time doing things that don't challenge. I have the children at home with me all day, every day, and it's enough for me. That's enough. I don't need more drama. I don't need to watch drama on TV. I've got drama in my house. You know, I don't need any of that. So if I find at the end of the day that I can get a couple of hours of no one's bothering me and I'm just letting my brain simmer down, really, then we put up with pretty much anything if we can manage that.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I'd love to talk to Scott about self-care because I know he's the king of self-care, aren't you, Scott?
I'm the worst, I have to say. I am the absolute worst.
Your Twitter feed does not reflect that position.
No, that's unfair, because that's not, you know, it's not every day that I'm, you know, but no, I am not.
Just the weekends. But your Facebook status is it's like a atlas.
Well, yes, it is. I was just going to say that I don't class that as self-care, but I guess in a way it is. But listen, I've refused to go away between Christmas and New Year. I've put my foot down this year.
You're a martyr.
I tell you. But it's interesting because I don't think I can do it at home because I think that I'm thinking about it as I'd say it, but it might sound completely stupid, but I don't think I can do it at home because there's just too much going on. Whether the kids are here or not, whether I'm at work or not, there's just always so much going on. There's always something popping up. So I think I find it quite difficult to switch off, which is why I think probably the only time is, and bearing in mind, having a 17 and an 18-year-old as well in the house, they don't go to bed early.
Yeah.
And that's really hard because you're just, you know, you've got four of you until everybody goes to bed, basically, you know. And I do, that is one thing I do miss is the adult time, you know, from about when they were chained up about 5:30 in the afternoon, you know, and they went, disappeared under the stairs and all that.
I've got my head in my hands, Scott. I really
you
have.
Do. I don't really care. But having Jacob now...
You do know this is going out, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Everybody knows that I do not chain my children up.
Awkward silence.
Tumbleweed. But yeah, and then having the 10-year-old, like last night, it was a nightmare because he said, oh, it's school holidays, I don't have to go to bed at 9. I was like, yes, you do, because I want peace and quiet. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges I found as the children got older, that actually that shrank to the point of me saying to them, would you turn the lights off when you come to bed? Or not come to bed, and go to bed. Don't sleep in one big, huge bed. Anyway, what I'm going to do now is that if we listen to Hannah Meadows' little interview, it was really interesting because I have to confess I'm a total self-care cynic. I'm rocking my stereotype, my northern stereotype. Just push through, man. So I had a really good chat to her, and I think, well, I'll let you listen to it and see what you think.
Well, hello, Hannah.
Hi.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. The main reason I wanted to speak to you was because I know that you are, in my mind anyway, you are a self-care woman. So
that's very kind of you.
Well, I see these little things flash up on my Twitter feed of all the various ways we can care for ourselves. But would you be so kind as to give me an introduction to who you are, what you are, why you are, all of those kind of things?
Sure. I'm Hannah. I'm married to Pete. We have 2 adopted children, Joanna, who's 8, and Charlotte, who is 6, and they've been with us for 4 years.
Right.
And I started getting interested in self-care probably about 18 months ago and started blogging about it. And there just seems to be a lot of people really interested in it because it's something that tends to sort of get pushed to the side because we're so focused on the therapeutic parenting and all the admin that goes along with being an adoptive parent. And, you know, adoptive parents are really good at that sort of stuff, but less good at kind of looking after themselves quite often. And there are a lot of people saying, yeah, this is really rubbish, and what can we do to look after ourselves a bit better, which in turn helps us to parent better. So I don't speak at all as an expert. I'm just kind of a mum, and I'm struggling my way through it like everyone else, and I mess it up.
I'm not sure there are any experts, are there, though? It's, as you said, it's not an issue that's discussed. So by definition, if you're one page ahead of everyone, you're the expert.
I don't feel like an expert at all, you know. It's always a battle to prioritize it on top of all the other stuff that we're dealing with. But I know for myself particularly, sleep is massive for me, and if I don't get enough sleep, and if that combines with me being dehydrated, then the monster comes out, you know.
I'm going to pull you right back because you're running into self-care, and I want to start at the very beginning because I'll be honest, I really like my stereotype of a northern man. I'm really running with that, and it's done me 45 years and I'm good at it. I'm kind of slightly skeptical as a human being. As a social worker, I totally get it. But as a man, I kind of think, what's all that about? And start me from the very beginning. How do you define self-care?
I define it as a kind of a discipline about keeping yourself recharged so that you can be at the top of your game. So, you know, it's not sort of airy-fairy. I mean, Sally Donovan was talking about this at the conference at the weekend, saying it's not bubble baths and candles.
Good.
I think of it in, I've got sort of 7 basic building blocks of self-care.
Right.
I've blogged about them, and they all alliterate nicely, which pleases me. Sleep.
Oh, I'm going to stop you because you're racing through this.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I like willing participants. but I'm really interested in the idea of it being a discipline, because I think it's, I mean, in your life, is it something that you actually kind of schedule in your calendar? Is it that sort of level of discipline?
I'd like to say yes. The reality is no. A lot of people, I think of self-care as just kind of treats, you know, a cup of tea and a bit of cake, or a bubble bath, or going to the spa, or whatever. And it kind of gets that kind of treatment. And it's much more kind of rigorous and all-encompassing than just sort of something you tack on. It's stuff like making sure you get enough sleep, making sure you've got support,
Right, run me through your seven then, because I can see
okay. Sleep is number one. That for me, you know, without sleep, I'm rubbish. Mm-hmm. And support, getting your support network sorted.
So that's number two. I am going to slow you down because there's seven. Sure. And we could do this in 2 minutes or we can do this in 10 minutes. It's up to you.
Okay.
But I'm aiming for longer than shorter. When you say support network, because I do FORMF assessments as a social worker, and I often talk to people about support networks, and they go, "Oh, my support network's great." And I think, yeah, likely story, because that's my natural cynicism.
Sure. But
people don't get that until it hits the fan, do they?
Yeah.
And I mean, what's your experience? I can talk about me, but with the interviews with you.
Yeah. We found that our parents have been fantastic.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of other friends who are fantastic. And everyone else will comment on Facebook statuses. And that's about as far as it goes.
Do you think that is? Do you think that it's people are just a bit freaked out? Because some of the stuff that I know,
I guess what we post about the sort of stuff, when our Facebook is in lockdown, Twitter, on blog, I share pretty much everything, but our Facebook is in lockdown and we say stuff on there about the reality of what's going on with our kids. And I think people are just a bit, whoa, what's going on there? Are wanting to be supportive, but just don't know where to start.
So have you had to do sort of an education with those network of people?
I mean, we find, you know, a lot of people find it really difficult to ask directly for help. So it's stuff like asking for very specific stuff like, you know, a night of babysitting to start with.
It's not babysitting, ask a 14-year-old down the street to come and do a couple of hours, is it?
It's someone who probably has their own children and has like the basic idea of childcare, but also people who probably are friends with us on Facebook where we do share. And it's really tough stuff to bring up in conversation. Oh, yeah, by the way, this is going on. But on Facebook, you can hide behind your computer. So we do share what's going on. Yeah. And so anyone who is friends with us offline as well as online knows the score, really. It's usually stuff once they're already in bed, so it's not like massively challenging dealing with behaviour. So we would start them from something straightforward and go from there.
Yeah. So that's support, and that's obviously quite developed. I mean, we could do a whole hour on support. So we're on to number three. What's number three?
Number three is sports, which isn't necessarily organised sports. It's exercise generally, but it begins with an S. So
I see how that works.
Yeah. So it's basically the idea that exercise helps you with stress.
Yeah.
And I've thought for a long time there should be adoptive parents kickboxing classes to help you really deal with the stress.
I couldn't possibly condone where that's going. Self-defence classes I could run with.
Yeah. Just to get some of it out of your system, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, any form of exercise that allows you to release some stress, gets your endorphins going, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, as I would say from the north, it blows your tubes out.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one that I hadn't realised, because I think as I've thought about self care, I've realised there's a lot of stuff I do that is self care, but for whatever reason, I would never call it self-care, but I go running and cycling, and if I don't, I unravel very quickly. If I don't get some fresh air and my blood running.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good that you've highlighted that one, right? What's number four?
Sustenance. Oh. Eating well.
Biscuits.
I've got biscuits later, eating well. The research shows that if you're stressed, you're more likely to eat like junk food. That's certainly true of me. I mean, I turn to Nutella straight away with a spoon out of the jar.
Wow, that's a confession, isn't it? That's a proper psychological problem, isn't it?
I confessed that a long time ago. I find that that goes really quickly for me. Mm. Those the two that I'm particularly rubbish at are the exercise and the eating well part. But it is important that you know
that sort of self-discipline,
giving your body what it needs to actually function.
That's good. Well, I'm just counting down my list. We're up to five, sure. Aren't we?
Five, yeah. Five is space, which for me means taking a step away from all the stress. I'm a massive introvert, so right. a lot of meetings and face-to-face time with people, and I can do it for a few days, and then I start to get shattered and just need a day, you know, doing something on my own, whether that's going for a walk or just kind of being at home reading a book, or you know, even just working on my own without having to do too much interacting with people outside of my family. I find that really helpful.
I guess over all of these, there's a kind of an implication that you need to get self-aware.
Yes, definitely.
And I know throughout my 30s, I was just in a terribly bad mood. And then I realised the main reason was I need 10 minutes alone every day. If I don't have 10 minutes alone, I become a monster. Mm-hmm. And so I make sure I get that every day, and no matter what I do, if I can get 10 minutes, then I'm fine. And I usually just watch telly, but it's 10 minutes on my own watching telly. Yep. But that's self-awareness, and that it's surprising how many people aren't that self-aware. Mm-hmm. So how did you, I mean, would you describe yourself as a self-aware person?
I think so. I've read far too many self-help books, you know, and those sort of personality tests and stuff. It's always something that I've been really interested in. I'm just really curious about that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I guess I've always had that.
Sort of inward looking.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. I'm not judging you. Don't worry. You're one of these, but are you like the good Mrs. C? She's always doing these things on Facebook, you know, what type of psychopath would you be or whatever it is. And, I just can't be.
I love all that stuff.
Do you?
Hilarious. Yeah, I mean, not so much thing though. What kind of fruit are you? But you know, all the Myers-Briggs tests and stuff like that, I find really interesting. Oh. You know, ever since we had to do, did you have GCAL when you were at school? And it's this sort of assessment you do for yourself to work out what kind of career you should have. And it told me I should be an MP or manager of fishery. You know, really. Practical day-to-day stuff.
That's such a natural crossover at that point, isn't it?
Obviously. Wow. Yeah, there are a few other things I don't know.
Well, you went to a posh school. I obviously went to a school where they just said, you're a boy, you're in construction.
We had this computer program we had to do at school, and it told you what career you had. And since then, I've just been, fisheries. Where did it come up with that? So, yeah, I guess that's probably where it started.
Now, in my mind, you need to change your Twitter profile to fish. That's what you need to do. You could be the new John West, couldn't you?
Tiny bit of a tangent.
Yeah, well, we like tangents around here. I am the master of the tangent. I believe we're up to... Right. I can't quite get over that thought of you being in charge of the fishmongers or fishery. Number six.
Number six is spirituality.
More.
So I write that from a position of being a Christian, but that's not necessarily where everyone's going to come at it from. So I include in that things like meditation, reading, praying, you know, all forms of spirituality. And I find for me that gives me a sense of perspective when I'm right in the middle of all the rubbish. And for me, it's my motivation for adopting in the first place. So I find that really quite grounding and helpful.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people, I used to think of religion in kind of fairly binary terms, but I see that there's a sliding scale of spirituality, and people find, you know, some people are walking the woods is a spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, I would class myself as a Christian, but I would class that as a spiritual experience as well, because I like trees and it makes me feel close to God. Mm-hmm. Not that God is a tree. Unless you want him to be a tree. Oh, good grief. I can see my social work registration flying out the window. But no, that's a really interesting point. I think that I'd like to come back to you about that one day. Sure. Because I'm planning a podcast thing on spirituality. And I think it's hinted at, and I see it everywhere, but it's never very rarely overtly spoken about. So there you are. Mm-hmm. I'll book a space in my diary. So what's number... Seven
is superfluities, which was the only word I think of that actually describes treats, which is the bit that tends to get focused on when people are thinking about self-care.
Biscuits.
Cakes and get into biscuits, cakes and candles and baths and spas. But that's not the whole picture.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a place for that stuff. But I think it's in the context of looking after yourself more generally. Mm-hmm. For me, the idea of a treat is, you know, a day of A, childcare, and B, sitting under a blanket on the sofa with a pile of books and a cup of coffee. That's heaven for me.
And I guess all of these have got to be filtered through who you are, where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. There's sort of an underlying framework, but then of course it's very individual as to what works for each person. You know, I wouldn't prescribe that everybody goes running or whatever for their form of exercise, so I wouldn't, you know, presume to know what somebody else's idea of a treat. So yeah, it's all very flexible to fit an individual, and what is going to actually recharge one person's battery is going to be different, isn't it? So
I found this really interesting because I wasn't the cynic, really. Well, maybe I was. if it involves biscuits, you've got me. But I hope I'm not being too flippant, but I think that you've made me think about it slightly differently in the level of discipline, and actually you are sustaining what is a very difficult task over a very long period.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, we're doing sort of Olympic level parenting. So it's like a training program rather than, you know, some sort of plug in every fairy business. You know, it's not an optional extra, and it's not selfish, and it's not narcissistic or thinking you're a special little snowflake. You know, it's an intelligent response to dealing with long term stress. And it's what helps to keep you from having a complete breakdown, you know, and getting sucked into all the rubbish that comes from dealing with, you know, the trauma that our kids present us with. You know, they've been through horrible stuff that gets projected onto us, and we're mopping that up and containing it. And therefore, the intelligent thing to do is to look after ourselves, because we're in a position where we have access to the facility to self-care, you know, in a way that the kids don't necessarily know how to do that for themselves. So we have to model it for them.
Yeah, so I think that what you've said there is fantastic, really, and it kind of moves it away from the temptation of perhaps me or somebody who's perhaps cynical to kind of go, yeah, you just need to get on with it. But you know, like you said, it's an intelligent response to long-term stress, because this is a marathon, not a sprint, and we can all sustain the levels of parenting that we do for a week, 2 weeks, and, you know, knuckle down, just plow through. But we're doing this for 20 years, 30 years, lifetimes. That's fantastic. I am aware that by the time this podcast comes out, it will be Christmas. So come on, give me your top 3 self-care tips for Christmas.
Oh, goodness me. Keeping it simple, number one.
Like that one. Simple is good.
Simple and low-key and kind of not overloading yourself with a massive to-do list, and making sure your expectations are realistic, both for yourself and for the children. Simple, number one. Simple. Number two, build in some downtime for yourself, whether that's, you know, if you're with family over Christmas, you can get them to take on a bit of childcare while you go for a walk, or hide under the duvet, or whatever it is that's going to recharge your batteries. Oh, goodness me. Number three.
Biscuits.
I'm really into this Danish thing of hygge at the moment, with, you know, fires and blankets and hot drinks and biscuits. So I'm intending very much to build some of that into Christmas.
I like the sound of this.
Yeah.
I had a feeling we were going to talk about hygge.
Oh, yeah, we have to talk about biscuits and yeah, coffee and hot chocolate. Proving really useful in our family at the moment. You know, the kids come in after a rubbish day at school, and we'll light the fire and give them a hot chocolate, and everything's pretty much fixed within half an hour.
It's a good recipe for life, really, isn't it? Just
absolutely. Yeah. So.
Well, that's wonderful. I like those three. So simple, downtime, biscuits, Well, yeah. Hygge. Taking care of yourself. Whatever. just as, you know, in a flippant manner, what is your favourite biscuit?
Milk chocolate digestive has to be up there.
Oh, well, that was a lovely interview. finish that off. I can't believe you said milk chocolate digestive. you've undermined all the good things you've said up till now, because we all know it's actually a bourbon. But anyway.
No, you're so wrong.
Do you not know who I am? I'm Blogger of the Year. You can't say that to me. I should be sponsored by bourbons. That's
not
a thought.
It's get qualifications, I'm afraid.
Is it not? Blast. Hey, well, joking aside, it's been really interesting, and it's something that perhaps should be taught preparation classes and post-adoption support, and it should be hardwired into every post-adoption support worker's mind.
Definitely.
This intelligent response to long-term stress. I like that. Self-care. Cool. So tell me, where's your blog?
HannahMeadows.com.
And where's your, what's your Twitter thing?
It's at HL Meadows.
And you have a Facebook page as well?
It's Hannah Louise Meadows, with dots in between those.
Right.
But all the contact details on the contact page of my blog, so cool. you can find me there.
And when's your book out?
Not for a few months yet. I'll let you know, and I'll come back on and talk about my book.
Excellent. If you bring biscuits, you can talk about anything. Well, I'll get my manager to speak to your manager.
See what we can arrange.
Yeah. Hey, well, have a good Christmas, and I hope things turn a corner, and everything's cool and groovy.
Thank you very much. Lovely to speak to you.
And you.
Okay, so that was Hannah Meadows. I really enjoyed talking to Hannah, I have to confess. And I was a cynic, and I think I'm convinced that the idea of it being like an actual appropriate response to this idea of professional parents. Because actually, I feel like I've started to feel like a professional parent. My parenting isn't normal. It's a confession.
Well, I agree with you, but I also agree that bourbons are the best biscuits.
Do you?
And I think that's much more important than whether it's
what
professional parents or not.
Bourbons.
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 What do you call them?
Bourbons.
Bourbons. Bourbons, bourbons, who cares? They're brown, they've got chocolate in the middle. They're bourbons, bourbons, whatever.
This is deeply concerning.
Well,
your accent. Are you posh Scottish?
I'm anglified Scottish, I believe.
Excellent. So what I found interesting was it was actually just this idea of a systematic approach to looking after yourself. And is that something that rings a bell with you guys?
No. Not really. I think I don't think I recognise self. I recognise the need to self-care, but I don't recognise when I need to self-care, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, you know, like Rachel was saying earlier, you can't pour from an empty cup. But I don't actually... It's almost like one of the traits of my children, actually. I don't have a cut-off point as to when I need to do that. So, you know, I'll be running empty for a couple of days and I'll go, oh, yeah, I know what I need to do. I need to top up on whatever it is that I need to top up on.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think it's interesting that so many things you could put in the self-care category. Things that I wouldn't necessarily think about, which I think is interesting as well, because I always think of it as just cake, biscuits, wine.
Yeah. Candles, baths. Yeah. Not the idea of
candles
and baths is terrifying.
The stuff that's
to
bad
me.
For you. The stuff that's bad for you is what I believe for self-care. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Rachel, what is interesting, because obviously Scott and I are in relationships, not relationships, that's a rumour start. But you're
kind of,
yeah, as a single carer, you know, is there someone who you go to or someone who kind of can speak into your life and say, hey, you need to do whatever you need to do?
Yes.
Or are you self-aware? Yeah.
To a point. I'm not desperately self-aware, no. I'm just not like that, really. And I think while I appreciated a lot of the things that Hannah was saying and agree with them, I don't disagree with them, I am so far away from reaching the stage of organising my self-care, you know. And I think I'm more like what Scott was saying, that on the third day of being like your children, and then you suddenly, oh, hang on, it's not them. This is not them, actually. This is me. Yeah. This is tipping the cup over again. And nothing in the cup, and I'm trying to give them more therapy. The first thing I think before any of that happens is you need to become a lot more aware of what your triggers are, where your grumpiness is coming from, where your lack of calm is emanating, you know, and what the things are that can restore some of that for you. I do have a couple of friends who are not adopters, but who are extremely understanding.
Yeah.
That I can speak to. But other than that, I'm actually quite private. Although it comes across maybe not that way on Twitter, but obviously I'm blogging our life. But actually, I don't blog a lot of details of our life.
Yeah.
And I don't discuss a lot of details of our life with people, partly because this is my children, and that's not how I want them into the world.
And that's, yeah, I mean, I'm the same. For all there's lots of words, there's not a lot of content. Well, you know what I mean.
See, I'm just a moaner. I must be just a moaner, because I think that I just, I must just moan on Twitter. Do I moan on Twitter?
No, Scott, no.
No,
that's not said much. I'm getting two conflicting faces here.
What you do is stir up levels of envy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say
photograph. No, I don't think you moan.
No.
There's mourning. I mean, we all do some mourning. I don't think Twitter's a mourning place, really.
No, I have a dedicated mourning Twitter account that I keep secret. That if anyone,
so you think
my infamous secret account that is just
so you think.
Yeah. Actually, I remember that there is someone who knows who it is. I'm going to have to kill them. Well, I think thinking about self-care, I think that actually it needs to be kind of woven into post-adoption support. And I think that the practitioners need to help people to practice it, whatever it looks like, you know, because you know, from Suddenly Mummy right through to, you know, to Hannah Meadows, we're different worlds apart, you know, we live in different lives, you know, and the thought of me sipping a gingerbread latte and reading Chaucer, honestly, that is a living hell, but for someone else, that's a beautiful moment. I mean, mine is eating a bourbon and being left alone. That's basically my idea of self-care heaven. Now,
just one bourbon. Just one, honestly, or one packet?
Do you think we could?
Because one packet would be my self-care thing.
One packet. Right. Yeah. Well, I do have a little Christmas quiz, and then we've got a special message, an alternative Christmas message from someone who's very special. I can't say who she is, right? But it's a surprise, and she's a very prominent member of the adoption world. But before we do that, I am going to give you a quiz. So it's a one-question quiz each, and the first one is...
Can we just be clear? Is this a quiz or a test? Just so we're clear on this before we...
For all intents and purposes, it's a quiz, but...
Right. Officially, it's a test.
It's actually a test.
Is there a prize? Because I don't think I'm doing this as no prize.
Well, there is a prize, yeah. You can be Blogger of the Week. I'll show you a picture of my...
Oh, here we go again.
It's a picture of my...
That's beautiful.
That is beautiful. Very beautiful. Look, there's another one here as well. Oh, look, excellent.
Oh.
Anyway.
Yawn,
I know. Right,
you were robbed that night, Rachel. You were robbed, I thought.
She was robbed.
You should have won it.
I know.
You should have won it. Yeah.
Okay, whatever. Rachel, I'm going to start with you. It's a simple question. Bourbon or bourbon?
Bourbon.
No, it's actually bourbon. Drinking alcohol is not very good for you. So I think, you know, that's no points to you. Scott, now to you. Now, are you listening carefully? Because it's Christmas. Mince pie or... Mince pie.
What are you on about? Mince pie or mince pie?
Yeah. Mince pie or mince pie? Just answer the
question. It's a mince pie.
No, it's a mince pie because at Christmas you have to have a sweet mince. So clearly both of you are rubbish at these questions.
And we're both sacked.
Both sacked, yeah. Basically, you failed the test, but I'll let you come back because you make me look good.
Oh, there could be more in this scenario.
It's getting very nasty. Well, thank you very much, Richard. It's been lovely to see you and speak to you. And I am hoping that we're going to come back. I'm wanting to do a blog, Scott. I've been thinking about this, about taboos. Ooh. And I think we should get Rachel back and we should speak about adoption taboos. But then I started to think about adoption taboos and I thought, I can't even mention them because people will link them to me.
This is a problem, you see. This is a problem when we don't have, what's it called, pseudonyms like Rachel does.
Yeah.
We have to, you know, you do often have to be quite careful about what you say. Some people call it sitting on the fence. I call it being careful.
Careful.
Yeah, careful and diplomatic.
I would really like to do a blog about taboos.
Mm.
A podcast. Would you be up for that, Rachel?
Oh, yeah.
Champion, would you be up for that, Scott?
You know, I bring it on with the controversial subjects. I'm full on with that.
Excellent. And I shall do that as well. Well, thank you very much. It's been great to meet you, Rachel. Say something. Say goodbye.
Thank you. Sorry.
She's
lucky. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Merry Christmas to you, Rachel.
We are flying abroad tomorrow for our Christmas, so
I'm
just getting that in there before I go. Christmas in France.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and I hope everyone has a good Christmas, and now we shall have our alternative Christmas message.
Ladies and gentlemen, please be upstanding for Sally Donovan.
Hello, podcastees. This is my alternative Christmas message for 2016. I had intended this to be a little bit funnier than it's going to be. I am sat here with a slow gin just to try and make things go with a little bit more of a swing. It's not been a terribly funny couple of weeks around at my house, so I'm going to do my best not to make you feel too miserable and to pep you up a bit for this Christmas season. Very nice that is too. In a speech to mark the 40th anniversary of her accession to the throne, the Queen referred to 1992 as her Annus Horribilis. One can only wonder how she's going to refer to this great year of 2016. I have a few suggestions for her. Annus Unbelievabilis, Annus Insanianius, or something. That doesn't sound right, does it? Or just maybe Annus Anusi, Year of the Anuses. There's been plenty of those. In some ways, the discomfort we might be feeling as citizens of this fair country, and indeed citizens of the world, apparently that's not something we're allowed to be anymore, but there we go. In many ways, that may be a similar discomfort to that those of us raising families imperfectly stitched together and impacted by trauma may experience. We may, all of us, foster carers, adopters, kinship carers, special guardians, have to learn to bear what might to others seem unbearable. And we have to bear with courage and fortitude because our children, let's face it, they rely upon us as safe havens. That's not to say that we do it perfectly, or that we do it consistently, that we do it without an occasional loss of nerve, without complaining, because frankly, that would be impossible. I look back over this year and I think of all the challenges, the fastballs that have come my way, all the times it's shocked or surprised me, the times I've had to dig deep, retreat or stand tall and breathe. And it feels, every year feels something like a mini lifetime. And for all its challenges, 2016 has taught me and reminded me to keep learning, to root my confidence in what I know and my experience, to gather good support around me and to take the long view. The short view is rubbish, in my opinion. The short view just cons us into great leaps of either optimism or pessimism, when it's really about the long trudge, the hard work, the unsung, unglamorous stuff. That's what pays off. It's the long view that allows us to spot and appreciate the progress and the healing that's taking place. And for most, but not all of us, it is there. And for those for whom it may not be evident, then the focus of the long view may be about self-preservation and recovery. And if that's where you find yourself this Christmas, then I wish you very well indeed. It's common to hear people say that their experience of parenting a child who has suffered trauma through maltreatment and loss has made them a better person. In my dark moments, when it's all got too much and I'm scared and lonely and when I can't face having to carry on, I wonder if in fact I'm a worse person for it. Whether I'm just a bitter, angry old witch, whether I'm full of self-hate and impatience, whether I'm just cold and withdrawn. These dark moments occur when times are incredibly tough, as they are sometimes, and when I haven't prioritised my own well-being. Now, I'm going to say something that some of you may have heard me say lots of times before, but it's a message that I know that I need to hear again and again. If you share your life with a traumatised child or children, then you must take care of yourself with a drive and an intense focus that is not required of those around us. And there will be those around you who don't get it at all, especially perhaps if you're at the start of your parenting journey. Time spent on self-care will increase your capacity to stand fast and to do what's best for your child, and then perhaps to send those people some reading material in the new year. Help them to catch up. Doing what's best for our children and not what just keeps the peace is perhaps never more difficult and yet more crucial than at Christmas time. And if you don't celebrate Christmas, you may recognise other significant festivals that should carry similar health warnings. Doing it differently for many of us becomes a necessity of survival and hopefully of better than that, of creating a Christmas with good memories, making healthy deposits in the bank of good times. And what better gift at Christmas can there be than that, other than perhaps an iPhone 7 or an Xbox One? Yeah, I know. So, looking ahead to 2017, it's going to be time soon to think of making New Year's resolutions. Now, I'm going to urge you to do one that takes into account your self-care and your own nurture. So not something that takes more effort than you're expending currently, not something that makes you feel worse about yourself, not something that particularly you can fail at, but something that enriches your life. So, I don't know, here's some just throwaway suggestions. Spend more on wine. Ask someone to babysit. Give up something you hate doing. Buy yourself a nice pair of shoes. Stop watching Question Time. This is mine. I started this a few weeks ago. Stop watching Question Time. It just makes you feel worse. You get a terrible night's sleep. Avoid people who make you feel depressed. Buy yourself a great book. Listen to a great podcast, such as this one. Buddy up with a fellow adopter or foster carer. Someone you really like. Go out and eat cake together. But most of all, never, never forget that in parenting a child for whom there were no other options, and a child who was perhaps traumatised by maltreatment and loss, that you are doing something amazing for them. You may not feel appreciated for all your amazingness, but you really should be. Helping someone to feel safe enough to accept some nurture and some kindness, to take part in a healthy human relationship, to value and love themselves, is an incredible thing. Really incredible. So to all of you, I wish you a peaceful Christmas with good times and many moments of nurture. And I wish you and all your family the very, very best for 2017. And good luck. Happy Christmas. Goodbye.